Next on the Mole, Jan Hocken and Joe Clement, they review the film, it's a holiday film, Miracle on 34th Street. They reflect on today's gender war. They also reflect on today's gender wars. Think Harvey Weinstein, Donald Trump, and many, many younger studs without money.
Let's start by a synopsis of Miracle on 34th Street, and we don't have to worry about spoiler alerts on this one.
No, there are a few different versions of this, but this is the oldest one from
1947. It's kind of like Bible stories. You've seen them and heard them many times, and apparently knowing the ending does not spoil them for many. Miracle on 34th Street is a 1947 American Christmas comedy drama written and directed by George Seaton and based on a story by Valentine Davies. The story takes place between Thanksgiving Day and Christmas Day in New York City and focuses on the impact of a Macy's department store Santa Claus who claims to be the real Santa. The film has become a perennial Christmas favorite. Part of what's interesting about the film, it's on my own personal favorite list. I think I know it scene by scene. I've seen it at least a dozen times. But it's made its way to the top of many feminist holiday favorite lists. So why do you think this resonates with feminists since it has many of the conventions of the 1940s? And we can talk about how some of the Hollywood censorship codes do operate in this film. What's your take on it, Joe?
Well, one of the main characters played by Maureen O'Hara, Doris, is a very successful executive in Macy's, and she's apparently a divorcee. She has a young daughter who's about 6 or 7, and she, in addition to being successful, is doesn't seem to have any problems parenting her child, and she is both respected in the workplace, and she is respected by another character in the movie who ends up courting her. There aren't really the typical sorts of stages in their courtship, which in a way reflects on how she is valued and respected as a woman in the film. But she also raises her daughter with this sense of don't be taken in by illusions. One of them being the Santa Claus story, which the film spends most of its time kind of skewering or trying to. And then there is this implicit illusion that women are falling under when they are taught that there's a Prince Charming out there who
so
will
those
save
fairy
them.
Tales.
Yeah, fairy tales in a literal and then in a cultural colloquial sense.
And it does carry some of the post-war conflict around women who had entered the workforce in historically unprecedented numbers, who occupied positions formerly held by men. And so you could see it as a historical transition piece or cultural expression of authority women still had, and not all women wanted to go back to the home, even if that option was available to them. There was a lot of it spoke to a certain post-war set of aspirations for women that were massively quashed in the 1950s, but it was very much, I think, a post-war piece of work and an expression of the gender ambivalences of that period. What about the ending, though? And then we can talk about other aspects of what makes this a feminist film. But one way of looking at the politics of film is in its denouement. How is whatever conflict emerges at the center of the story resolved at the end? And of course, at the end, spoiler alert, the girl gets her wish, the daughter, for her mother to have a house. It's not so much she wants her mother to have a husband, she wants them to have a house. And they do get this house at the end, and her suitor, who pursues her with offering childcare and cooking, which was also part of its progressive charm, they do get the house. And so it has a kind of domestic coupling at the end, which would undercut its progressiveness.
Yeah, but it's still, I think, a much more relatable coming together of people as they do. We are a coupling species, whatever kind of ideological battles we want to have over what that really looks like. And so it's, it's relatable enough, but they don't, yeah, they don't have any of the telltale signs of marriage per se.
Or her giving up her job.
Or her giving up her job. And I mean, for a film that is as concerned with psychological fitness as this film ends up being, there's also no suggestion that she's really debilitatingly crippled emotionally or spiritually by her divorce. She is a little jaded about, you know, having been tricked by Prince Charming, who we're not really sure what happens, but it seems to have rubbed her the wrong way. And this she imparts on her daughter with this very practical-minded, don't, you know, fall for illusions, don't believe things that aren't reality. And there's the suggestion that the mother has maybe limited the daughter in a way that could, if it went on this way, harm her. But what ends up happening is Santa is kind of this relief of helping the child start to get back in touch with her being a child and having an imagination, which if you watch the film, you find that she doesn't really understand how to use.
And he's a very benign old man, a grandfatherly man who, I mean, by today's standards, you wouldn't see an old man like that left alone with a little girl in a bedroom. But yeah, at that time, he was not coded as sexual. And so there is an exploratory freedom she has with this old man around her. Her imagination that stays pretty much in a secular area and not taking it in a religious direction. Well, one way of reading this film against the current of the gender troubles for women that are center of controversy around sexual harassment is to admire it for positioning a woman in a powerful organizational role, which many feminists are calling for as, and in part correctly, one of the antidotes to sexual harassment. If women have more power in organization, also have more power to mentor younger women and have the authority to discipline men, we'll have less sexual harassment. So you could read it as a call for women to have more positions in corporations and other organizations, more positions of authority.
Yeah, though they call her an executive, she is also kind of simultaneously referred to as simply an events planner, and that fits in with traditional expectations of women as performing the social labor of putting on events.
Yeah, but she has sufficient authority that she can make things happen, and she does not. She's classically beautiful, but no one comments on it. She's not pursued in ways that are diminish her in any way or challenge her authority. And one might say, well, isn't that a fairy tale too? Because the reality is women, even at all levels, do put up with their sexuality being kind of assessed in a certain way. They can be too homely or too beautiful. It's never quite right, you know, in terms of you risk it either way. So how do we think about this film as an ideal, though, that the answer under capitalism is to have women running the show more, if not the events, the main act?
Yeah, the film is conservative in the sense that it is a story about how capitalism can regain its humanity, so to speak. The whole, you know, film is driven by this Santa Claus character becoming the Santa Claus at Macy's, and he starts to tell children, opposite of the orders he was given by Macy's, to just direct them to Macy's own toys, that they have an overstock. So there's a commentary on capitalist overproduction and how this Santa figure is supposed to help align consumers with this overproduction and solve that crisis for the capitalists. He tells people to go wherever they have it, if they don't have it, or wherever there's a better deal. And this ends up coming back to Macy's in the form of customers saying, Macy's is this, you know, great public actor. They're putting people before trying to make a buck just for themselves.
Use value over exchange value, yeah.
Right, and In this way, the film is trying to recuperate this vision of where capitalist society shortly after the war could be going. And you know, it is a vision that I think thinkers like Slavoj Žižek catch up on when they notice how companies like Starbucks and many other companies try to make the consumption of their particular product itself the fulfillment of an ethical duty because of carbon offsets or sending money to a charity.
That companies are not simply selling products. They're selling cultural values, he calls this, you know, cultural capitalism, or the commodification of values and ethics in the context of selling goods. But it also, Miracle on 34th Street also has a certain critique of that, because it's quite clear that the executives are using this to sell products. And so you could also see it as maintaining a kind of critical edge about that, the illusion of an ethical consumer culture. And so it raises some questions and maybe anxieties about the post-war period and the power then at that time of the big department stores that were like the cultural the cultural square, the city square, and occupied many of those same values in people's lives and place in people's lives. But doggone it, it's a good film. I think it's still, we're seeing, and always, like other films, we're talking about through the contemporary lens of concerns.
This has been Joe Clement and Jan Hocken talking about the original 1947 Miracle on 34th Street. You can find it on YouTube. It's probably going to be playing on TV somewhere, or find it at the library.